This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Assalamu alaikum. We are here today with Abdul Hakim Murad to discuss his latest book, Travelling Home, Essays on Islam in Europe. Sheikh, this book has just come out. Can you tell us a bit about it?
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thanks so much for taking the time for having this conversation with me about my new book, which I suppose better late than never is the best way of looking at it, but reflects some of my thinking about some quite hot topics that I've been pondering over the years. And it really does, I think, represent me stomping across a number of minefields to do with the new body beliefs, to do with gender, to do with integration, to do with racism, to do with Muslim community leadership, to do with Islamophobia. So I'm going to consider this book a kind of cat that I'm throwing amongst the pigeons. It's dealing with some of the most controversial issues on earth. And I've decided that I'm going to speak quite frankly this time. But inshallah, there will be light generated as well as heat. But thanks again for doing this.
So let's begin with the first essay. You speak about liberalism as well as traditional Islam. Do you believe that traditional Islam can still flourish in liberal Europe?
Yeah, I think that the question of the overlap zone between liberalism and Islam really can only start when we recognise that those are two very diverse phenomena. There's different types of liberalism. There's certain liberal beliefs that are going to be difficult to square with traditional Islamic teaching. And the Muslim family, of course, is diverse as well. But one of the things that I'm reaching for in the book, I suppose, is the idea that liberalism itself across Europe seems to be morphing in a coercive way. And the paradox is not far to seek. In other words, it is no longer a question of the traditional Rawlsian or Lockean vision of liberalism, which is that the state takes no view on the worldview of the citizens, and more towards a coercive view whereby the state increasingly expects compliance with certain social beliefs that are regarded as being paradigmatically liberal. I think the worry here is not just for the prospects of social cohesion as people are being forced to believe certain things, but also that this has handed a stick to the xenophobic movements across Europe, which they are using to beat immigrants, conservatives, Jews, as well as Muslims, so that this coercive liberalism becomes a kind of badge of European identity, which is really feeding into the mounting prejudice against people who don't fit in, people of conservative religious backgrounds, conservative Christians as well, who increasingly feel that they are pushed out from the centre of the consensus of European liberalism in the name of liberalism itself. So there's clearly a paradox here. Can liberalism tolerate anything other than itself? And I think it's very important that Muslims get their heads around this question, because increasingly it is central to the whole conversation about the future of thriving Muslim communities, not just in the UK, but across Europe.
So, of course, when discussing the role of Islam in modern Europe, we have to, of course, comment on the role of the media has played recently. You mention in your chapter about the Bosnian War the reluctancy of politicians and the media to acknowledge the role that religion played in the war.
Yeah, there's a whole chapter about Bosnia, because I think that we exist in a post-Holocaust world, we exist in a post-9/11 world, but we're also very much, particularly as European Muslims, inhabiting a post-Srebrenica world. Srebrenica, the largest atrocity, act of genocide, and its perpetrators convicted at The Hague of genocide and crimes against humanity that we've seen since Auschwitz. And this is clearly, insofar as the Muslims were the victims, of enormous concern, not least because so many of the anti-Muslim zealots across the world really are looking to the radical Bosnian Serbs as paradigms of Western, white, Christian crusaderhood. So that, for instance, Anders Breivik, while he was carrying out his Utoya massacre in Norway, wrote very much of his inspiration by the example of Karadzic and the Bosnian Serbs. Similarly, the Christchurch Mosque massacre was done by somebody who was singing Chetnik radical Serbian religious songs as he was shooting down worshippers in the two mosques in Christchurch in New Zealand. So there is a sense in which we know where that road leads. Anti-Semitism starts us on a road whose terminus is Auschwitz. Islamophobia clearly is taking us along a road whose terminus is Srebrenica, ethnic cleansing, mass murder. And I think it's very important that we focus our minds on this rather grim outcome, not as a possibility, but as something that is still there. And as an example, Serbian religious Orthodox Christian nationalism, a kind of strange idolatrous worship of the national self, is something that is not confined just to the Balkans or to the Slavic or the Orthodox world, but is increasingly a paradigm that inspires a shockingly large number of young anti-Muslim zealots really across the European continent. And the role of the media has often been quite invidious, in that in Bosnia all of the stereotypes were inverted, weren't they? The usual Western narrative is innocent Christians being massacred by evil Muslims with daggers in their teeth coming to ravage and ravish them. But in Bosnia, it was so exactly the other way round: peace-loving, pluralistic Muslims being mass-murdered by their cross-carrying Christian neighbours, that the media kind of went into a meltdown and didn't quite know how to deal with this. The narrative was flipped so absolutely. And we need to remember that there is the same reluctance on the part of mass media, not just tabloid media, when confronted with the reality that most acts of communal violence in European countries now are perpetrated against Muslims rather than by Muslims. And this is something that the media is uncomfortable with, and clearly the consumers of the media are incredulous about, but it's very important for us to set the record straight.
I like the fact that you have an entire essay on environmental issues. What exactly do you mean, though, by the term creation spirituality?
Yeah, it's quite a punchy and argumentative chapter, I think. Not everybody will like it, but essentially the emphasis that is kind of a fard, a wajib in our time, on preserving creation is one of the things that differentiates a spiritual or religious discourse from a purely secular materialistic one. The Green Movement, the ecology parties to date, tend to regard the natural world as something worth protecting because thereby we protect our own future. It's utilitarian, functional, defensive. I think that from a religious perspective, and particularly the perspective of the Qur'an, which is nothing if not a great collocation of wonderful hymns to the glory of the natural world as a sign of creation, moves a long way further than that and gives a stronger heart to the Green Movement and the Green Parties, insofar as we wish to protect nature, not just because it's the life support system for our own species, but because nature represents the symphony of God's signs, the ayat. And everything in creation, according to the Qur'an, knows its own form of prayer and its own form of tasbih, of glorification, which means that the other ummas, and the Qur'an does speak of other species as being ummas, umamun amthalukum, nations like yourselves, have the right to be here. Whether it be the pangolins or the mice or the horses or the Siberian tiger, they have their haq, their right in this creation. And the traditional mizan, or balance, that obtained for 99% of human history, whereby human beings existed in a kind of balanced relationship with other ecosystems, has been completely overthrown by consumerism, secularism, materialism, a utilitarian view of things as being there for us to make products out of. And I think we really need to push back against materialism and secularity, because that's the basis of their instrumentalizing of the natural world, which for us is blasphemous. So yes, a creation spirituality, that's the term that I'm using here, that we look at the world not just as blobs of matter, but as something that is attributed to a creator. and that therefore is redolent not just with messages about how we might make money out of creation or how we might, in a utilitarian way, want to protect and preserve creation, but also is something that, as we inhale the beauty and the aesthetic of the natural world, takes us closer to God and reminds us of our point of origin, Eden, and our point of return, inshallah, which is Jannah. So, yes, to see creation in a spiritual way, I think, is essential if we're going to move forwards and take the green movements out of the margins of our political and discursive life and put them where they have to be, right at the centre of the conversation about the human future and human survival.
So, because of the outbreak of the coronavirus, we are all in lockdown right now. No one really knows what's going on. There's a bit of a panic. People are overbuying. No one knows what's happening. You do comment on the coronavirus in your book. What do you think people can take away from the book during this time of crisis?
Yeah, it's important, isn't it? We live in extraordinary times and everything has been upended. The corona crisis in society and political life and in the medical apparatus, the corona crash in the markets, the new Great Depression which seems to be upon us, millions and millions of people out of work, tens of thousands of people dying in quite distressing ways. The world has changed enormously in the last few months. And so I do talk in the book about what we can make of this as Muslims and what are likely to be the implications, not just for Muslims, I think, but for other vulnerable minorities. Don't forget that one of the precursors of the rise of Nazism in Germany was the Great Depression. And the Great Depression had been preceded by certain demographic and psychic turbulences caused by the influenza epidemic a few years earlier. Epidemics create a kind of earthquake in human society. So I think we're already seeing conspiracy theories of various kinds. They tend to be pretty anti-Chinese a lot of the time. But they're anti-Muslim conspiracy theories as well, which of course are flourishing everywhere. And the result is likely to be, as far as we can see, and we're still only at the beginning of this alarming episode, that the rich will get richer, that the money which is now filtering out of the bank accounts of the poorer is going to end up somewhere and is likely to be with the global 1%, that minorities, refugees, asylum seekers, other people who are right on the edge of European cultures already have a lot on their plate in terms of their cultural, economic, social, political position, are now facing high mortality rates, the problem of loss of social cohesion because of the social distancing regulations that are now across Europe, except Belarus, but basically this is our new normal. And that as a result, it's going to be easier for the far right in this unsettled, unhappy, agitated Europe to find these minorities as a useful sort of whipping boy or as a scapegoat for things that ultimately clearly are not their fault. So I talk about COVID-19 and the corona crash in certain contexts in the book. And of course, it's a watch this space situation, isn't it? But clearly, we are in new territory. And I think that Muslim thinkers and writers really have to be quite quick in responding because the world has the right to expect some kind of guidance or reflection from us, inshallah.
So you cover the topic of identity a lot, Muslim European identity in your book. Being a Muslim and being Western can create a lot of conflict when it comes to one's identity. But your book shows actually that there is a surprisingly strong Muslim history in Europe that many of us are not aware of. How do you think Muslims can draw from this when creating or trying to understand and establish their personal identities as European Muslims?
Yes, identity. Everybody is worried about their identity and panicking about their sense of self. Sometimes this is egotism. They just want to feel that everybody loves them and sees how wonderful they are. And so they say, I am this, I am that, and I affirm my whatever it might be. And this is tiresome because in a religious context, I do talk about this in the book, we're not really supposed to be terribly obsessive about ourselves because we're more interested in God and in helping neighbours and family and so forth. We reach beyond the self and we find happiness not in soliciting the approval of others, but rather in trying to serve others. And Islam is not unusual in the world's rainbow of religions in this respect. But the question of who we are in Europe, I talk about in several chapters in the book, because Europe, of course, historically invented itself as being that last bit of the ancient world, the Roman Imperium, that didn't become Muslim. Everywhere else, all of the great cities of the Roman Empire, they became part of the enormous, suddenly appearing, unexpected Ummah of the Khilafah. And this little appendix to the ancient world, which is the European continent, was the only bit following the Battle of Poitiers that didn't enter Islam. You have to remember that the Muslims went 92% of the distance from Medina to Cambridge. One more push. And, well, the University of Cambridge's curriculum would, as Gibbon remarked, look rather different. But a little bit of Europe was left. And from that little bit, it started to expand again with the Crusades, the Reconquista, crossing the Atlantic, and now rules the world through itself or through the ethnically cleansed Americas. And as a result, Europeans, as they think about their identity, whether or not in the context of defining this common European home that Strasbourg is always hyperventilating about, have to look back to, well, what made us Europeans in the first place? The Roman Empire was about the Mediterranean, really. It wasn't about what we call Europe. And the first usages of the word Europenses to mean Europeans actually come about in crusading chansons de geste type poems. It was only when the Muslims appear that Europe is created, and this is the famous Pirene thesis that historians talk about. So there's a problem then for European integration with Muslims if the peoples against whom Europe self-defined are now minorities in Europe, 25, maybe 30 million of them, significant minorities, then what exactly is the narrative that Europe has in order to regard them as just unproblematic parts of the European family? So I talk about this, but of course the demography means they have to continue to import people from neighbouring countries, which happen to be mainly Muslim countries. So I talk about Léon de Passy's famous sculpture, which is outside the European Council building in Brussels, which is Europa and the Bull. It goes back to Homer, like the beginning of European literature. Europe begins with this nymph, Europa, who is carried off from Lebanon, the Arab world, by Zeus to Europe and gives birth as a result of that curious union to the Europenses, to the Europeans. And now you have that image outside the European Parliament, which to me, I guess they didn't intend it, seems to reflect their awareness that Europe can be sleek and powerful like a bull, but it needs the importation of an Arabic fertility if it's going to survive. Actually, very good symbol for the European Union. So we have to be part of that conversation. And what I'm trying to do with the book really is not to look at it from some standard ethnographic or sociological point of view, because there's so many different theories and they have very little predictive power, although it's useful to know how many Muslims are there in France and basic data like that. But to do it from an insider's Muslim perspective, to look at Islam's own indigenous resources for migration, integration, respect for the religious other, neighbourhood, the common cause, the common good, all of those things, the public square, and to see how those resources, which are very considerable in our tradition, as opposed to, say, some of the sort of fundamentalist movements, which almost as Europe used to be, exists precisely as a kind of counter-narrative to Western hegemony. They are based on a negativity rather than a sense of what's important and indigenously rich and valuable ethically about the tradition. That Muslims need to think theologically about what it is to be precarious minorities in a continent where more and more people are voting for these anti-Muslim populist parties. It's an age of the growth of national populism. And we need to react not sociologically or by going crying to the European Union or to Strasbourg saying, please protect us from this wicked Islamophobic person, but instead to see how we can idfa billati hiya ahsan, as the Quran says, react to an aggression with something better, something more beautiful. Instead of just complaining, let's see if we can come up with something more therapeutic. And that, I think, is the more authentic religious response. So really the core of the book is a Muslim theological argument about how we can change our discourse and flip it from being moaning and demanding rights and demanding protection and turning it into something more positive and proactive, and I think more likely to be respected, and certainly better for da'wah, which is what can we do to help this continent that's in the grip of so many crises. And you mentioned the environmental one, that's just one where we have a very strong discourse, but there are many others. So really the agenda of the book, of the manifesto, because it's very kind of argumentative, a lot of people are not going to like it. It ruffles a lot of feathers, but this is the most controversial issue in the world, the West and Islam, that I'm proposing the ressourcement, the return to the resources of that enormous, huge thing called traditional Islam, those neglected, dusty libraries, in order to show how we can be therapists, not complainants, in modern Europe. How we can actually help to heal people, their spiritual crisis, their moral confusion, their arguments about gender and identity and this and their worries about the body. All of this is something that instead of despising and feeling superior about, we should be reaching out to see what's wrong and how we can help. And the medicine chest of Revelation is full of some very powerful remedies. So basically that's what I'm looking for in terms of this question of identity. And there's, of course, individual questions of what is a specifically French Muslim identity? What would a Danish Muslim identity look like? And this is something that theorists like me are not really going to be able to shape, because it's to do with human beings working out their own solutions and young people defining for themselves what they want to be in these hybrid situations. And a bunch of ivory tower academics are not really going to lead that conversation. But we can theorize it, and we can show where Islam actually does recognize the possibility of cultural diversity and inculturation and a positivity towards neighbors. And alhamdulillah, we have such rich resources for that. And I've tried to explain that Muslims need to have more respect for their own heritage, because it really does provide an extraordinary set of solutions for this darkening crisis that Muslim minorities across Europe feel that they are entering.
Well, thank you very much, Sheikh. We really appreciate you taking the time. It's been very fascinating. Thank you.